The Florida pastor who threatened to burn copies of the Quran says he feels like he's been lied to and may yet go ahead with his protest. Terry Jones had cancelled the event, claiming he'd reached a deal on the siting of a new Islamic centre, but it now looks like there's no such agreement. Our Foreign Affairs editor Tim Marshall says there are still unanswered questions.
Will he or will he not go ahead with this, because he's now left it open? Has there been a conversation between him and the authorities of the mosque that is proposed to be built close to Ground Zero? He says yes, and they say no. One of them is lying.
Meanwhile, around 10,000 people in Afghanistan are protesting against plans to burn copies of Islam's holy book. It's reportedly the largest demonstration so far. As another police force announces job losses, there's a warning the only winner from the funding cuts will be criminals. Hampshire Constabulary's axing 1,400 posts. Following the announcement by Kent Police, it's getting rid of 1,500. Minister Nick Herbert says he understands the Police Federation's concern about government cuts, but believes savings can be made.
We're determined to protect the front line, and that means reducing bureaucracy, and it means making sure that police forces can work more efficiently, can collaborate, share services and drive out cost.
Around 2,500 jobs have been rescued at a housing maintenance firm, Connaught, which collapsed earlier this week. Administrators have struck a deal with the construction firm Morgan Sindall to sell the social housing division. The agreement is worth £28 million. A new drug for people with type 2 diabetes could soon be widely available on the NHS. Victoza works by stimulating the release of insulin and reducing appetite. In football, England striker Jermaine Defoe is out until the end of the year. His club Tottenham say he'll miss the next 3 months after undergoing ankle surgery. And it's the end of an era in reality television tonight. Fans are getting ready to say goodbye to Big Brother. The last ever episode goes out on Channel 4 this evening. That's the latest. I'm Chloe Culpin.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
BCFM is a community radio station for Bristol. So what exactly does that mean?
Well, it means that anybody can get involved in any way you want.
Yeah, but what if you haven't done radio before?
That doesn't matter, because BCFM have qualified tutors that run training courses that tell you everything you need to know.
To find out more information, go to www.bcfm.org.uk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. It's the ninth anniversary of the September 11th attacks in New York and Washington tomorrow, and with a nasty so-called pastor from a tiny Florida church making headlines right around the world, we look at some of the latest revelations about the attacks and ask, are the mainstream media asking serious questions about these attacks yet, or are they still bumbling around in the dark, led by the latest sensation? Also, it's Bristol's Anarchist Book Fair tomorrow at Hamilton House on Stokes Croft. I'm joined by one of the organisers after we have a brief look at Bristol Open Doors Day, which takes place tomorrow. And Marina Morris reports on the placebo effect. Can pills with no active ingredients cure you by mental power alone? Anyway, Open Doors Day, and it's Bristol's annual day tomorrow with venues open all over the city. One building that will not be open, though, is Bristol Freemasons Hall at the bottom of Park Street. However, there are some interesting buildings which will be open between 10 a.m. and 4, and here are my recommendations for what it's worth. First is number 22 on the list, Red Lodge Savage's Wigwam, the Red Lodge on Park Row. It's in the reconstructed Tudor Knot Garden of the Red Lodge. The Wigwam itself is a 20th century mock medieval tithe barn with two fine 17th century fireplaces, at least so the brochure says. And more interestingly, it's the meeting place and gallery throughout the year of Bristol's most curious and exclusive arts society. Entry is via the Red Lodge on Park Row, and there's also a wheelchair accessible entrance in Lodge Street. My other recommendation is number 46 on the open day list. That's Merchants Hall up in Clifton, which is the headquarters of Bristol's elite and discreet. Their membership lists include a handful of people, including the Queen and architect George Ferguson. They're merchant venturers. They were involved in the slave trade and have had an important influence on Bristol's history for more than 450 years. You'll see many fine paintings and historic artefacts in an imposing Victorian mansion. There'll be guided tours of the hall at regular intervals. And that's on the promenade, not far from Bristol Zoo. All the open doors venues tomorrow are open from 10 until 4, and there are leaflets all over the city, as well as a very grand-looking website with all the venues listed. Well, Hamilton House on Stokes Croft is a hive of innovation and activity. The new bar there has really helped bring life back onto Stokes Croft itself. Tomorrow, it's the venue for Bristol's annual Anarchist Book Fair, with activities from all over the country converging on Bristol with their radical publications and spreading the messages that you may not find in W.H. Smith's or in Waterstones. Now, I'm joined by Phil, who's one of the organisers. Hi, Phil, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. Thank you for having me.
Tell me, first of all, what is an anarchist?
Well, an anarchist is someone who believes that people can organise their own lives without the government and the state telling them what to do and taxing them and doing all the things that people could perfectly well do by themselves.
Now, anarchists are often seen as not believing in the law of the land. Is that true?
We don't believe in laws that are imposed on people. We think there should be like rules and norms in society, but people should agree them rather than being told what they are by the rich.
But I mean, if you're in some sort of situation, for example, somebody is attacked or whatever, you would call the police like anyone else, wouldn't you?
It depends how serious it is. In most instances, I'd probably try and sort it out myself. If it was someone known to me, I think people can deal with that in their own communities.
Now, why don't we see a lot of the literature that's going to be in Hamilton House tomorrow? Why don't we see these kind of stuff in W.H. Smith?
You're starting to more, but a lot of the big like book retailers tend to steer clear of this stuff. But it is breaking into the mainstream. There's there's a lot of popular books now in places like Blackwell's. I was in there yesterday. Authors like Joseph Stiglitz, he's got quite famous. He's worked for the World Bank, and he's had some good selling books recently.
Now, at the book fair itself, it's not only books, is it? So what else is going on?
Yeah, so we've got about 50 stalls. Maybe half of those are straight booksellers selling radical books. The other half are campaign groups, various campaigns from Bristol and around the country, all sorts of things, animal rights campaigns, unions, anti-fascist campaigns, really wide variety of stuff.
And I mean, I can remember getting DVDs at a previous Bristol Anarchist Book Fair. Why at Hamilton House? Why have you chosen that as a venue?
Well, Hamilton House is a new venue. We were looking for somewhere a little bigger this year. Like every year we've managed to grow, which is a good sign. Hamilton House is right in Stokes Croft, where a lot of us are already doing work at various different venues, like the Free Shop and the Anarchist Bookshop on Stokes Croft. And it's sort of kind of alternative area of the town. There's a lot of activism going on there.
So can you just give us a few examples of some of the groups that are going to be there and the kind of literature, whatever, that there will be on offer?
One group we're excited to have is the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty from Canada. They're coming over to do a talk about their work.
So you have talks as well?
Yes, yeah. There's about 30 meetings throughout the day.
Crikey.
Some of them are about things like the Coalition Against Poverty, who help people in Ontario dealing with issues related to poverty when they haven't got enough money, like sorting out problems with landlords, all sorts of things. Then other meetings, we've got a whole range of historical meetings organised by Bristol Radical History Group, and another room organised by Bristol Indie Media, who are doing talks about topics like censorship, activism.
I'm particularly interested in this Bristol Radical History because I think there's quite a lot about our history in this city that is a little bit embarrassing, and sometimes the establishment don't really like to trumpet it. So can you tell us about some of those talks that are going on through the day?
Yeah, I mean, maybe you're alluding to Bristol's role in the slave trade, which is...
Well, it's not just that. I mean, I think there's quite a lot of trades that Bristol's been involved in over the years, which are could potentially be embarrassing. And also things like big riots and things like that. So can you just take us through some of the stuff that's in the Bristol Radical History Room?
Yeah, well, there's one talk about the St. Paul's riots in the 80s, looking back at that and some of the issues there. We've got meetings looking at the history of anarchism in the Southwest. And yeah, it's all quite local, the history they're looking at. Some stuff about Swansea and what used to go on there.
Well, what did used to go on in Swansea?
Well, there's this guy, Ray Jones, he's going to talk about his life. That looks good. And then another meeting about Athens, like looking back at ancient history and how
Athenian
society works.
Is this people from Bristol talking about Athens, or have you got people also coming from other parts of the world? I mean, you mentioned Canada.
Yeah, we've got people coming from all over the country, like a lot of people come down from London for it now. And yeah, it's big anarchist scenes in a lot of towns.
Martin, maybe I can bring you in here, Martin Summers, our old Labour Oxford economist. Martin, the whole anarchist scene, do you think there's any real interface between it and mainstream politics? Because I think the anarchists often see themselves as kind of outside that, and yet they're quite influential, aren't they?
Well, I mean, obviously, there are anarchist books in mainstream bookshops. There are. In the history sections, you'll often find them. What you won't find, of course, is the independent publishers, which you will have tomorrow. It's usually the big publishers. I mean, you mentioned Joe Stiglitz. I've never thought of him as an anarchist. Is he an anarchist? I didn't realise that he was.
Well, he's more critic.
He's a critic. He's a critic of capitalism, yeah. I mean, anarchism as a respectable intellectual history as one of the major criticisms of the way a capitalist society is organised. And I personally, I'm not an anarchist, but I can see that there's plenty of things that anarchists talk about which are of vital importance. And anarchism has actually got a history of its own, so that it was anarchist militants were major players in the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. They had mass movements of millions of people who were organised around anarchist ideas, and this is not something marginal, really. It's just something that's been in abeyance and never really had much traction in this country, but in countries like Spain and Italy it's been very important historically. And I think that we're at a time when people criticising capitalism is very much the order of the day. I mean, capitalism needs to be criticised, no doubt about it.
So what would you be going along there, Martin? What's the sort of thing
I might drop in. I might.
So what's the sort of thing that you think that anarchism has to offer people who maybe haven't come across it much before? Whereabouts do you think? I mean, you mentioned Joe Stiglitz.
Well, he's not an anarchist, as we've just established. He's a critic of capitalism and a rather mainstream one as well. I mean, personally, I think anarchism's got all. You know, you don't knock it till you've tried it. It's like lots of things in life. You should explore these ideas and make your own mind up about them. Don't take the propaganda of others. If you want to meet anarchists, go along tomorrow and you will meet them, and then you will find out what kind of people they are, won't you?
Phil, yeah.
So yeah, some things we've been involved in Bristol. A lot of anarchists are involved in helping people with housing issues, helping people who've been forced into squatting because they can't afford to rent or they've been evicted. Working on community safety, trying to deal with street violence by getting communities to work together when the police have failed to tackle these problems. Anarchists mostly run the free shop on Stokes Croft, which kind of recycles unwanted clothes and goods and gives them away freely to people who perhaps can't afford them at these times with unemployment as it is. So anarchism's quite sort of practical and tries to deal with problems in the community. When we're let down by the government, which you see at the moment with unemployment going up and they're threatening to cut everyone's benefits, like when people can't find work if they want it. So it's time for people to pull together maybe and look after each other.
Martin, do you think that because of the economic situation, the recession, as Phil's saying there, threats to take away benefits and things like that, anarchism may be something that is actually on the up at the moment, in a sort of growth industry?
Let's not say anarchism, let's say direct action, which is what anarchists believe in. That's basically doing it rather than talking about it. I think there's a clear necessity for people to understand the law around squatting, because we're going to have a second leg of the economic crisis. People who think they're secure are going to lose the security of their property, of their homes, and squatting is not just a kind of stopgap measure. It's the only way to prevent yourself from being pushed onto the street, and it's one of the ways in which we need to fight back against this offensive by the ruling class.
Martin, you're preaching doom and gloom here, because many people believe that it's the private sector sector is going to actually bring us out of recession.
Well, they can believe as much as they like. I mean, I think Phil will agree with me. It's not just the government that's the problem. It's capitalism as a whole, of which the government is a part. It's not we're in a society in which we're dominated by people bigger and stronger than us, and some of them are in the private sector and some of them are in the public sector, and we need to start getting people need to understand the arguments that float around about what we're going to do about this mess that we're now in. And anarchism, I believe, has got a lot of practical, as Phil stressed, the practicality of anarchism. What I see in anarchism, which I approve of, is the practical activism. That's the stuff. That's what cuts the mustard. We can talk about the theory till we're blue in the face, but getting things done is the great strength of anarchism as a philosophy, in my view.
But Phil, do you personally yourself get engaged with the whole electoral system and the political system? I mean, we've just had a couple of councillors in here. Do you vote?
I don't know.
But don't you think? Actually, by sort of withdrawing your vote, that you're sort of just opting out of the current political system, and actually it would be better to actually get engaged and try and push your views through there as well as what else you're doing.
Yeah, I'm not dead set against voting. I would be tempted to vote for the Greens, but I don't. I think that's just one little thing. I don't think whoever you elect, they will solve all the problems we have. I don't think the government has the power to solve capitalism's problems.
Well, actually, that's funny, because Martin was saying that a couple of weeks ago, that a lot of major policies that... Martin, I think you're right. I don't want to misquote you, but saying that there's a policy lock on some of these big policies, and it doesn't matter who you vote for.
Well, that's right, and I think that's what makes people not disillusioned on principle, as Phil is perhaps with the political system, but a lot of people realise that it doesn't matter who you vote for, because basically an oligarchy behind the scenes decides what happens. We're talking about a financial oligarchy aligned with a military industrial complex. So this does exist. It's got several million members, probably 1 or 2 million, but these people are the power, and people that everybody else... I mean, for example, I went to a BBC debate on the cuts on Sunday night, which was shown last night on Southwest TV, and we had three businessmen, the one businesswoman from America and two businessmen, telling us all the things they would like to cut. And that was regarded as a debate. There was no... And the audience, by and large, I must say, there was people in the audience who were MPs and so on, but most of the ordinary audience were absolutely stunned that this was the kind of debate that we're being presented with. And in a way, it was quite revealing. It wasn't politicians who were telling us what was going to happen. It's three people we've never heard of who were multimillionaires from Bristol who were telling us what's going to happen. And these are the people behind the scenes who were actually pulling the strings. It was quite amazing that they had the cheek to come out in public and make their pitch. But I think that was rather... I don't know whether I approve of what the BBC did or disapprove. In a way, I disapprove, because it's very... spun the argument in the wrong direction. But in another way, it's very revealing, isn't it? Don't bother talking to the organ grinders. You know, don't bother talking to the monkeys. Let's talk to the organ grinders, the wealthy classes that buy the politicians. And they're almost kind of cutting out the middleman and telling us straight, you know.
Now, there was a leaked document, wasn't there, last week, when Mark Thompson went to visit Downing Street. And one of these wonderful occasions that are happening quite regularly recently, where the photographers who are standing in Downing Street with these long lenses get fantastic digital snaps of the papers as people are going into the cabinet meetings. So what does that tell us about the BBC?
Well, maybe let's be really conspiratorial, Tony. Maybe, but Mark Thompson allowed them to read the memo that he got. I mean, what that memo was saying is that the government were very, very keen to make sure that the whole debate around the cuts is framed in their terms. We are going to cut. What are we going to cut? And that was very much the way it was presented by the BBC last Sunday, which was broadcast last night. Now, frankly, that begs a lot of questions, because it's not actually clear that we should or could cut. I mean, the point I would have made if I'd managed to get my hand up, or I did make it later to the...
You couldn't put your hand up.
Well, I put my hand up, but I wasn't called. Is that the problem with trying to cut a deficit, the one we've got now, is that as you cut, the economy crashes and the deficit gets bigger, which is exactly what we've seen happening in Ireland. In other words, this is not just unfair, patently unfair. We had a multi-million... millionaire hedge fund man telling us we got to get rid of all public pensions. I was gobsmacked. I mean, it's amazing. But the fact is that this won't work, that the economy will go down. I mean, and also, of course, that Wall Street is about to crash again. Yeah, it's not just a question of what we do here in this little rowing boat called Britain. You know, there's a great big storm brewing out there which is going to hit all of us. Now, I would see anarchist ideas as a very important part of the mix as we build a mass movement to change the society for the better. I'm not an anarchist. I don't agree that we should opt out of all of these ways of fighting. But, of course, what anarchism brings to the feast, in my view, is this emphasis on don't wait for somebody else to do it. Get off your bum and do it for yourself. And there's a lot to be said for that. It's not the only answer. You can't always win, but just by doing that, I think in a way you get locked in to small battles. And you don't fight the big battles. That would be my view. But certainly, getting off your backside and doing something is far more important than sitting there and watching the television, which is where everything is basically being stitched up in front of your eyes.
I imagine you agree with that, Phil. What about is there an anarchist critique of all this kind of current situation with the cuts? I mean, we're talking in North Somerset Council, apparently, cutting over 1,000 of their staff. And this is, people are still having to pay their council tax and everything. It's just they're getting less and less for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really terrible, but it does kind of make us revisit how we got the welfare state, and it's kind of like as the state has done more and more, people have become more and more helpless, and they've stopped even doing the things that they used to do. Like 100 years ago, workers would all club together and pay a little piece out of their wage packet each week, and they'd hire a doctor for their union branch, and they'd provide their own health service. And after the Second World War, the government kind of came in and displaced all these like communities and all these ways of looking after ourselves. And now we're in the position that they can take it all away again. And what are we left with? So, I mean,
but that almost sounds like an argument against the welfare state, though.
Well, it's a difficult one because, I mean, Guy Barry Goldwater said that any government big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take it all away again. So it does leave people kind of helpless when you're relying on this sort of external thing called the state that we don't really have any control of.
I think this is quite interesting because, in a way, what you're putting is almost like a kind of conservative big society argument. And that's what it sounds like, to some extent. And, of course, you quoted Barry Goldwater there, who was an extreme right-wing US politician. I think this is interesting because once we get into this area, we get into the area of paradox. I don't see... what I am is I'm a minimal state socialist. I think the state should exist, but it should be minimal. And that most of things in society should be organised in the way Phil is suggesting.
Oh,
through mutual... I mean, you know, we should have mutual banks, cooperatives, all of that. I'm absolutely in favour.
But are you the sort of socialist, Martin, that doesn't want the utilities to be nationalised?
I think that when I say minimal state, that is quite a big state. Certain things definitely have to be run by the state, in my view. Now, of course, that state must be accountable, and that's the problem. If you look at places like the USSR or even China today, which China's been quite successful economically, but it's still not a free society. I wouldn't want to live in China, no way. And I think that you've got to, if you're going to have the state, then it must be, you know, I'm suspicious of the state, as all good liberal people should be, if you like. The state is a potential problem. But it's also a potential, you know, this is where I would differ with Phil. I would see the state as potentially empowering. And I think that at some point you can't just walk away from having a state. A state also protects you from predation by others. You know, that eventually the anarchists who were fighting alongside the socialists and the communists against the fascists in Spain, you know, they had to come to some kind of working arrangement, if nothing else.
Okay, so Phil, if you had to choose between one, the state or big business, which one would you choose between? Because I mean, we have discussions on here quite a lot about possible nationalisation of utilities and things which are essential services, which turn into things like transport in the city. How would you look at that? And is that the sort of thing you consider, the utilities?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd go with public ownership, but I think it can be done in a more responsive and local way than having it all run nationally. Like if something can be run locally, then let it be run locally, because then people can have some control over it and it can be sort of tailored to what people want to do in their town. Sure, some things you might need to organise over a bigger area, but we sort of have a principle called federalism, which means if you want to do something on a national level and people opt into it, it's not something that's like imposed on you when you're born. Like you're born into the British state, and and you have no choice. Like,
but you see, you're almost going against the tide there, because the general trend seems to be the opposite direction towards much bigger states. That is to say, the European Union, for example, and you know, that slowly but surely, local authorities. I mean, we were just hearing from Gary Hopkins that they actually, the cabinet can pretty much do what they want, despite what the entire council votes against them, even. So you are kind of going in the opposite direction. You're saying that it should be more localism rather than federal, you know, sort of something like the European Union running Britain.
Yeah, but at the same time, we're not at all nationalist. Like, European integration is good on one level. The problem with it is it's being done on big businesses' terms at the moment. I mean, anarchists are totally against states and nationalism. So we would like to see bigger countries, bit more integration, but at the same time, people should retain their identities, retain their freedom.
Martin, do you think at some point in the future we're going to see sort of clash between these ideas, where you know, the sort of the idea of United States of Europe and bigger states versus this kind of anarchist bottom-up approach?
Well, I mean, the bottom-up approach is going to be perennial, isn't it? It's always going to return, because people have to, you know, basically. The class struggle is inevitable, and people have got to fight to defend their interests, and that therefore there will always be something bubbling up from the bottom. I think the bigger states problem, the problem is, as we just said earlier, is that the state has lost control of the situation to big business. We have now got a criminalised states run by gangsters who are not even business people, they are gangsters. And this is a very dangerous and very extreme situation.
Can you give us an example of a gangster state?
I would name Colombia, which I visited on a trade union delegation some years ago. It's basically run by drug traffickers in alliance with the United States of America. Now, so is the state in Afghanistan, which British soldiers are dying to defend as we speak. This is the way the world is. And I'm all in favour of people criticising the way the world is organised. It absolutely deserves to be criticised, but it's not just the government. The real power in the land are private power structures. Private power structures which have parasited onto the public power structure, which is the state. Look at the way the banks have behaved. They're private interests, completely dominated by private profit, and when they got into trouble, what do? They take their hat off and say, come on, state, bail us out. And that's exactly what's happened, and that's why we're in the crisis. Private interests have captured the state. The problem is, what worries me if we walk away from the state is that they will never be challenged for that. You know, we've got to challenge those private interests and retake the state. That's how I would see it. That's where I would probably differ with Phil.
Now, Phil, in the first hour, we had a long discussion about this Area Green Spaces plan and the idea of selling off quite a lot of our green spaces around the city for housing development. What's an anarchist approach to making those sort of decisions? Because it's a real knotty one. The council have got targets, and they've agreed this in years gone by, and now some local people around the city are simply going to have to suffer with their green lungs taken away.
Yeah, well, I think people love having green spaces in the city, and I mean, selling them off seems like selling the family silver in a way, because what they're going to do next time they're short of money, going to have nothing left to sell one day.
So if this happened next door to you, what would you do about it?
Well, I'd make sure those councillors knew that no one agreed with it. And you have to see if anyone take notice of you, and if they keep on ignoring you, you have to ratchet it up a bit.
Can I just make a comment on this? Granby Green in the north of the city was a green space which was engrossed by a private developer who just put a big fence around it. And he was actually a lawyer from the Australian Supreme Court, even though he was born in Bristol. And he knew that if he put a fence around it, he could claim that land. And he did. And he had to be there for 24 hours. And some anarchists came down and said, well, let's just get through that fence and sell him, he can't do it. And all of the people were very much middle-class area. Oh, no, we'll try and go through the normal channels. If they had got through that fence and the security corps people on the other side, he would have lost that case. Yeah. So possession is 9/10 of the law. If somebody's going to take your green space away, well, don't let them. Barricade yourself in. Yeah. There are always methods that you can use. But you shouldn't give up using the other methods, in my view, as well. Use all of the methods.
Now, one of the big events of the week, we had a visit from Prince Charles down at Cabot Circus in his green train. The locomotive, we were told by The Guardian on Monday, the 6th of September, that hauled the prince around, has been hauling the prince around the country, is furnished with his bespoke study, a grand dining room and bedroom suite, complete with a bath and his and hers beds, on the start of what is a several-day tour this week of Britain. And he came to Bristol to open a green centre in Cabot Circus. One of the sponsors of the train is EDF Energy, which, interestingly, has just been a boycott has just been called of EDF Energy because they're planning to build nuclear power stations in the local area. So both Phil and Martin, I'd just like to hear your opinion on Prince Charles and his nuclear green credentials. Phil, you first.
Well, I'm not a supporter of the monarchy. Prince Charles isn't probably the worst royal that there's ever been, but it is a bit of greenwash, really. I don't know about his train powered on old ship fat. I don't think everyone can use one of those.
Martin,
I haven't got one.
Martin, what about this sort of because if this is whole thing is supposed to be a green thing he's opened at Cabot Circus, what's he doing travelling around the country sponsored by the people who are trying to build a nuclear power station next door?
Well, nuclear power station people themselves claim to be green, so you've got an issue there. As you know, James Lovelock and some of the leading Greens have decided that they do love nuclear power.
Actually, Lovelock, I think, is not 100% pro-green, but nuclear.
I'm just saying that there's a debate about whether nuclear power is green or not. I don't think it's green. I think the problem is greenwash. I mean, there is another problem.
We did have some Green Party activists on here who were very adamant that there's no way that nuclear is anywhere green.
I totally agree. So there is an issue there. But I think the other issue, a more important constitutional issue, and a lot of the things Prince Charles says I actually agree with, but he's not supposed to be mixing into the discussion. Is really, that's what the constitution basically, unwritten.
But he's entitled to his opinion, isn't he? And at least if he's spending some of his wealth promoting his ideas.
But the point is that he oversteps the mark. Look at the stuff he's done on architecture and so on. Now, he's got to decide. If he wants to be a politician, he's got to resign from being prince and to stand for election. And if he doesn't, then he's got to play within the rules. Because he might have, his views on population control are those of his father, for example. Would you like Prince Philip to be allowed to be in charge of everything? I don't think so.
What are his views on population control?
He's got eugenicist views that poor people should be, got rid of effectively. I mean, he's been caught saying that several times. Now, the problem is that people's opinions are entitled to their opinions, but a monarchy in a constitutional monarchy has got to be very low key. They can't be wading into every dispute. And that's the bit of the problem with Prince Charles, I'm afraid.
Now, let me put it to you, Phil, but a lot of the original anarchist writers, Kropotkin, for example, were part of the aristocracy. Kropotkin. So you're saying, first of all, in a way I'm sort of trying to entrap you with this story to do with Prince Charles, because a lot of the original anarchist ideas were from the aristocracy, and Russian aristocracy and other aristocracy.
Yeah, well, the thing about Russia you have to understand is it was a very backward society, and like the people who could read and write were often not the peasantry. But I mean, Kropotkin's famous, and there's a couple more famous aristocratic anarchists from Russia, but there's tens of thousands of anarchists, you'll never know their names, but were lifelong activists and did all sorts of things in their communities.
One of the other things, finally, to do with the Anarchist Book Fair that's happening later in the evening is actually a music concert as well. Do you want to tell us a bit about them? And then maybe, Martin, you can give us a review, because I believe you went to see this band yourself recently. A band called Zounds, as well as another one called Violent Arrest, and someone else called...
That's already happened.
Oh, has it?
That was the fundraiser last week.
I did go to it, but it's not happening now. It's happened already.
Okay, yeah, so...
On Saturday, we do have an after party after the book fair. We've got... two punk bands, Cop on Fire and Donderhond from Belgium, the Dagger Brothers, who are doing some 80s style dance music, and some DJs playing drum and bass and more dance music.
Where's that taking place then?
That's at Classics on Stokes Croft. It's going on from 8 till 2. We've got a licensed bar in there. It's £5 to get in. If you're really skint, then you can plead less on the door.
And Martin, can you just quickly give us a review of this Zounds concert you went to the other week?
I enjoyed it because I used to squat with Zounds in the 1980s.
Oh, well, so you're biased. But what sort of music is it?
Well, it's punk. But one of the things I was saying to people in the audience is it's a kind of punky, folky music, but you can actually hear the lyrics, which is what a lot of people forget. If you listen to things like the New York Dolls or even the Sex Pistols, it sounds thrashy, but you can hear the lyrics. And a lot of people don't get that. They thrash away, but they don't. What you need, you can get a thrashy sound without having maximum volume. You need to hear the lyrics, otherwise there's no point.
Phil, can you just wind up by saying, for someone that's never really come across anarchists or anarchism much before, a final little plug? Why should they come down to have a look at down at Stokes Croft tomorrow?
Well, there'll be all sorts of things going on. Like, this band will be something that interests you. We've got a lovely vegan cafe for a cheap meal. There's a kids' space if you want to bring the family. There'll be loads of people there. We had like 700 through last year, and we're expecting more this year. Yeah, it'll just be a really fun day. And
it's open day. From what time to what time?
From 10:30 till 6.
And Hamilton House is just on the right-hand side, about 300 or 400 yards up Stokes Croft from the city centre. Thanks ever so much for coming and joining us today. Now we're going to have a little chat to Marina Morris after this.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, Marina, nice to have you back, because you've been away for a couple of weeks. Certainly today we've got a quite interesting subject for us, and this is to do with taking pills that have got no active ingredients that actually could cure you. Now, this sounds almost unbelievable.
You are right. Is physical health also in the mind? Can't negative information destroy and steal our health? Research at the University of Hamburg, Germany, heated the arms of 38 volunteers over 6 days. Half of the group were told that heat would be increased. This half reported constant pain levels. The rest felt less pain as they got used to the sensation. The first group also had increased activity in the brain areas involved in pain perception. Researchers didn't expect that giving negative information for 5 minutes would have a negative effect a week later. Conversely, if you tell people a medical procedure will be extremely painful, they will experience more pain than if you had kept silent. Recent research of Parkinson's disease patients shows increasing evidence that fake treatments or placebos have an actual biological effect on the body. In the study, Parkinson's disease patient given a placebo after being told they had a 75% chance of receiving an active drug produced significant amounts of dopamine, a chemical key to the brain's reward system that is care in the brains of patients with this disease. Dopamine is a chemical naturally produced in the brain. Synthetic dopamine is often given to these patients. No dopamine response occurred in the patients given a placebo after being told they had a 25%, 50% or 100% chance of getting a beneficial treatment. As scientists explain, what that means is when you are told that the outcome is certain, that there is a 100% chance, you don't activate reward's pathway. At lower probabilities, you just don't think there is much chance, so you don't activate the reward system either. Also, experience of side effects within the placebo groups of drug trials have shown that a doctor's warning about the possible side effects of a medicine make it much more likely that the patients will experience those effects. Our mental and emotional health is still puzzling to us. The power of mind is an amazing force. For many years, placebos have been defined by their innate content and their use as controls in clinical trials and treatments in clinical practice. Recent research shows that placebo effects are genuine psychobiological events attributable to the overall therapeutic content, and that these effects can be robust in both laboratory and clinical settings. What does this mean? The force of thoughts can be powerful and valuable healing tools, and it is much more better to focus your energy on positive healing thoughts than destructive negative emotions. How can medicine benefit from this knowledge? Experts say that the doctor-patient relation plus expectation of recovery may sometimes be enough to change a patient's brains, patient body, and patient's behavior. That's all.
Thanks very much, Marina. Martin, do you want to just a comment about this, about things being psychosomatic? What do you think of this? Is this real? Can you take something that's got active ingredients that helps make you better?
Well, clearly it is. I mean, this phenomenon has been known for quite a long time, hasn't it? It's not a recent knowledge of modern medical science. Placebo effect has been known for quite a long time, at least a generation.
But the recent knowledge, effect?
Yeah, I mean, we're clearly, as Marina says, we clearly don't really understand the relationship between our minds and our bodies yet. We're still working it out. I wouldn't go so far as to say that you can simply, through mental belief, cure yourself of things. You know, some people carry this too far. There is a placebo effect, which clearly hasn't been explained by medical science, but that doesn't prove that mind controls matter. What we've actually got is something that we don't understand and that we're still working at. Absolutely. and trying to grasp. So I mean, things like homeopathy, for example, have been controversial on the National Health Service because some doctors say, well, it doesn't work apart from a placebo effect. But you can see that other doctors basically say that if something makes patients happier, then that's actually good enough in itself. But, you know, these issues are complicated and we need to keep debating them.
Thank you. Well, Martin, I'd like to have a chat with you now about tomorrow's September the 11th anniversary, because that's the 9th anniversary tomorrow. And I know you're part of a national campaign called Reinvestigate 9/11. Now, the context of 9/11, what is the context, in the historical context in which it happened?
Well, a lot of people don't realise that those who suspect something untoward may have happened on September the 11th, 2001... many of them, like myself, have knowledge of what the state has previously been up to. And I'm thinking of things that the listeners may have heard of, like the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s in the United States, where it was basically uncovered that agents of the state were involved in massive drug running, terrorism and murder. And basically bringing thousands of dollars worth of cocaine into the United States.
Can you tell us what the Iran-Contra affair was? Where was the drugs going?
Misnamed the Iran-Contra affair because when it came out, incidentally, through a plane being shot down over Nicaragua that was full of cocaine and had links to the CIA, when it finally came out, the Iran-Contra affair became the thing that upset the media in the US when they finally covered the story, was that some of the money had gone to Iran and that there was dealings with Iran behind the scenes because Iran was supposedly the US's enemy. But more shocking for independent observers was the involvement of the CIA and their allies in massive drug dealing inside the United States, which led to thousands of deaths in the inner city in the United States. The crack cocaine epidemic was effectively created by the CIA and Adolfo Calero from the FLN, the Nicaraguan counter-revolutionary movement. Now, The Bologna railway station in Italy was blown up in 1980 by agents of the state allied with the United States and the Western intelligence services. Now, these things are well known in certain circles, but most people don't realise that this has been going on behind the scenes for quite a long time. But, you know, it depends on your life experience. If you're talking to people in Belfast, they get suspicious about what the state gets up to. You talk to people in Surrey, they think it's all squeaky clean. And the fact is that it's not squeaky clean.
Now, one of the filmmakers that's over the years has made lots of films about this particular subject, I mean, we're talking about feature films here, is Costa Gavras. Now, why is it that so few of his films have actually been shown on TV, do you think?
Well, I mean, in these days of modern technology, people can look up Costa Gavras and watch his films. So, I mean, one of the Hollywood film that he made that was most successful was Missing, which was about the coup in Chile in 1973. And it had Jack Lemmon in it and Sissy Spacek. And it's a great film in its own right. But, of course, what it was showing there was the involvement of the United States intelligence services in murder and skullduggery. And that's their track record. And when you say, well, surely they wouldn't kill 3,000 of their own people, well, you say, well, hang on a minute, thousands of people were dying as a result of the things that they did previously.
Yes, but you see, Martin, there is a big leap of imagination, isn't there, between, or a leap of ideas anyway, between the US intervening down in South America and doing the same in New York City.
Ah, but the problem is, don't people realise that evil is not to be confined behind borders? That what they were doing in Nicaragua was funding their allies, the Contra, with cocaine shipments from Colombia. We mentioned Colombia earlier. Now, That is, and we're talking millions of dollars worth of cocaine here, and lots of, and all of the knock-on effects that come from that. Yeah, the shootings, the killings, this is ruthless stuff. The people who are in charge of in the West are not, in fact, the nice guys. They never have been the nice guys. And so, within that context, September the 11th, when September the 11th happened, because of all my knowledge for the years I've been involved in politics and the things I know about, my first thought was, oh no, they haven't. They haven't done this, have they? And of course, by the end of the day, I pretty much knew what, from my own mind, what had happened there. And of course, as you know, in the 9 years subsequently, lots of others have come to the same conclusion.
Now, what about this Reinvestigate 9/11 then? How does that all work? And what is the campaign up to?
Reinvestigate911.org is the website. I mean, we're basically engaged with lobbying decision makers. We're not there to inform the general public. There are various other people doing that. I mean, your own 9/11 Truth Forum is a more of an informative site. Reinvestigate 9/11, we are focused...
It's a blog, isn't it? Reinvestigate 9/11 is basically a
blog.
Yes,
it's a blog. But the reason being that we're not really there to enter into dialogue with people. Our goal, as we see it, is to talk to politicians and others in serious positions of power about this. And we've already had three meetings in the House of Commons, and we're planning a fourth meeting in November.
And I understand there's also a big 9/11 Truth Party going on tomorrow in London.
Passing Clouds, you can look them up on the internet and reinvestigate911.org. If you look at that, there's actually all sorts of events across London highlighting the issues surrounding 9/11, which we haven't yet covered. The questions that are being asked, I mean, architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, their website is ae911truth.org. They had a big press conference today in the press club in New York, and it's been covered on all the major internet, like Reuters and Yahoo have all covered it. Architects and engineers are extremely prestigious group. You can't join architects and engineers unless you are an architect or an engineer, and they've got 1,000 signatories now, all of whom have come forward and said the government's explanation of how these three towers collapsed, not two, three towers collapsed on 9/11, simply won't hold water.
Can you tell us the significance of why it matters that three towers collapsed rather than two?
Because the two towers which supposedly collapsed as a result of fires caused by aeroplane fuel. The third tower wasn't hit by an aeroplane and therefore had no fire caused by aeroplane fuel. And yet it came down in exactly the same way as the other two towers. If people are interested in this, they just have to Google or any other search engine. I shouldn't mention search
engines. No, you shouldn't, no.
WTC7, the third building. I mean, the BBC Conspiracy Files series did a whole one-hour programme on the third building. And these kind of things people need to understand. I mean, yep. How can a building collapse? I mean, the explanation for the collapse of the first two buildings is planes. It can't possibly be that for the third building. What the suspicion is, and nanothermite has been found in the rubble by researchers from the University of Copenhagen, Niels Harrit, is that these three buildings were bombed.
Now, there's a website I noticed the other day called buildingwhat.org. buildingwhat.org, and they were comparing this film of Building 7's collapse to that of the Zapruder film at the time of the Kennedy assassination, because
most
actually
listeners probably don't know the importance of the Zapruder film.
Well, this film of the Kennedy assassination wasn't released until about 1967, you know, yeah. 5 years after the event.
This is the nature of these things. It's usually years later that, through dribs and drabs, that these things come out. But the 9/11 Commission, which investigated, most of the senior members of that, and it's all there on our website, Reinvestigate 9/11, most of the senior members of that said we were lied to by the government. They didn't give us the full truth. Our investigation was blocked. Max Cleland, who is a senior senator, there is a senator at this press conference this morning, a Democratic senator from Arkansas was at this press conference with architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth this morning. So the message is kind of getting out there, and actually in the world at large It's already well known.
Why is it then that the mainstream media focuses on stories like this Florida vicar, priest, or whatever he is?
Well, I mean, you've got to understand, if what we're saying is correct, that what's basically going on here is psychological warfare operations by Western intelligence services, and that includes the Israelis, Mossad, then of course there's all sorts of distraction involved in that. You don't just blow things up. What you're trying to do is bend people's minds to your will. Basically, US American citizens, like most people, will not just go to war unless they've been given a sufficient cause. And of course, what these bombings and assassinations and people burning of Korans and so on does is it creates the conflict which you can then build on the back of. And of course, the real agenda is actually the old agenda, the imperial agenda, the agenda of the Kaiser, the agenda of Hitler, which is we are taking over your oil, your and also the agenda of the British Empire in its heyday. Let's not let ourselves off the hook. I mean, basically, behind all of this is the same old imperialist capitalist system doing what it does.
One man has made several incredible documentaries on this topic, but is sadly no longer with us after he died in mysterious circumstances in Houston Airport Customs Hall in the 1990s. This is Alan Frankovich. He was born into an upper-middle-class Peruvian mining family and then went on to study film in Los Angeles. Martin, I mean, he's made lots of films, Alan Frankovich. Can you tell us about his film, The Maltese Double Cross? What was the subject of that?
The Maltese Double Cross was shown in the Channel 4 Dispatches series and was about the Lockerbie bombing. And, of course, many people who have looked into this, including Jim Swire, who leads the relatives in this country, have concluded that the Libyans were not responsible and that the Libyans were framed for the whole thing because somebody else is being protected.
Well, anyway, here is Alan Frankovich speaking to a US video cassette news service, quite an old-fashioned one, from back in the 1980s.
The CIA now has the right to do things inside this country that it never legally could do before. In other words, and I'll predict that in the using the justification of fighting terrorism, and in some instances they are going to be encouraging and publicizing terrorist incidents in order to get everyone nervous. You're going to see them start doing things inside this country to control people that they've been preparing to do for some period of time. In other words, well, they have the right now, for instance, to infiltrate any kind of political organization, any kind of group at all in this country, which was what they were not allowed to do before, partly because of the problems of jurisdiction between the FBI and the CIA. They can do it on the flimsiest of excuses.
And if somebody who is a member of one of these organizations says, hey, I think that guy's a CIA, they can put him in jail for 5 years.
Exactly. Exactly, because they've just passed this law making it a felony to name the CIA people. And that's not going to stop, for instance, foreign newspapers from naming the names of CIA people. It is going to make it very difficult and intimidating for any American press. And as I said, the reason the CIA exists is not to keep these covert operations secret from the countries that are being targeted, the Nicaraguans, who are having their own people killed every week. No, the CIA is behind these things. We don't, though. We read the things and say, oh, it's just another one of those accusations. These operations are secret to keep them from us and to preclude our deciding what we want our foreign policy to be. And so it becomes moot who you vote for anymore, because the presidents are still going to go on using the secret instrument. And that's why I think the issue of covert operations of the CIA is critical.
Well, Alan, it's not just the names of agents which can be talked about anymore. It's any of the activities of any of the intelligence services, and that includes the FBI or the Bureau of Alcohol, Tax, and Firearms. That means that you wouldn't be able to make your documentary on company business now, right?
Right. It would be extremely difficult to make. But it also means that, for instance, if, and there are documented incidents, if you have someone in your group who proposes to you a terrorist incident and is actually working for the FBI or the CIA, and this has happened in the past, that you are not even allowed to name, to denounce him at a press conference that so-and-so has suggested we blow up an oil refinery, etc., and that we know that this man is working for the CIA, they could actually throw you in jail for 5 years
for revealing
that. Yeah. In other words, so you have no form at all of protection. And it's like creating the legal basis for the creation of an enormously powerful secret police force for use in this country.
Well, that was Alan Frankovich, documentary filmmaker, originally Peruvian, who was trained in the United States, who made many films in the United States about the US Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and also, very famously, a film about the Lockerbie bombing called The Maltese Double Cross. Now, Martin, do you think he's exaggerating there, that a lot of the laws that have been coming in to do with terrorism and things like that actually stop proper discussion about these state agencies? agencies?
It's got worse since he spoke. I mean, you've now got a whole plethora of new security agencies in the United States. We've got nearly a million members, all of whom have top security clearance, but nobody knows how many agencies there are or what they're supposed to be doing. The track record, I mean, Frankovich's best film, in my view, was the films on the Gladio network, which he showed on, was shown on BBC Two in 1993, I think it was. And I remember seeing those films at the time and thinking, thank goodness this stuff is finally making it onto mainstream television. But of course, they were shown only once on BBC Two, and they've never been shown again. And that's the way it works. We do live in a free society. You can say these things once, and then that's the end of it. It goes into the memory hole.
Can you tell us about that Operation Gladio then?
Well, Gladio was basically the code name for a whole series of terrible atrocities carried out in Western Europe during the 70s and the 80s, including the Bologna bomb, which killed 86 people, a bombing at the beer festival in Germany and in the south of the country, which killed 18 or 20 people, I can't remember. And it all came out through parliamentary inquiries in Belgium and in Italy that this was all being carried out by the Western intelligence services, and, that is to say, CIA, MI6.
And in Switzerland. There was another parliamentary inquiry in Switzerland.
Yes, I mean, that's right. So in other words, the point is that most people don't know this history. And the mainstream media continues to push a certain... I mean, if you were to talk to somebody in a mainstream TV news channel and say, well, I can't tell them this stuff because they wouldn't understand it. And that's right, because you basically, most of this stuff has been brushed under the carpet for years. So when something like 9/11 comes along, middle-of-the-road people in America and Britain just think, oh, gosh, I better believe the government about this. I don't know much more about it. They surely know what they're doing. In other countries in the world, in places like Colombia or in Russia, where General Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces, is on the internet saying, we're not happy with this explanation. Around the world, people don't necessarily believe what the US and Britain say. Frankly, we are regarded as people who speak with forked tongue. But we in our own minds, of course, we think that we're the good guys with the white hats. That's not how we're seen.
Well, let's finish up today with some music from Martin Noakes, who's a composer, author, music producer from Brighton. 9/11, Building 7.
There's a million reasons why I don't believe it. There's a million reasons why it can't be true. Open fire, can't melt steel. It's not hot enough. It's nothing new, it's not a mystery. Check out the Reichstag, Germany. There's a million questions still. Like the towers, it just fell. The fire's not enough, no way hot enough to bring it down. The project I
Martin Noakes from Brighton with 9/11 Building 7. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Conservative councillor from Froome Valley, Leslie Alexander, and Lib Dem for Knoll. That's Gary Hopkins. Thanks also to Martin Summers and Marina Morris. Next week, it's Brenda Hugill. Until then, I'm Tony Gosling wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.